Hi, I'm Jeff Clemente. I'm the VP of Business Development for SkyBrowse. Today, we're going to talk about SkyBrowse Hyper, our rapid 3D mapping and modeling. We're going to talk about our newest release, SkyBrowse Freemium, which is free 3D modeling. Then we might even talk about some of the other stuff that's currently in development. So stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. I'm Greg from Pilot Institute. We train drone pilots all over the country.
Hi, my name is Haya from Drone Excel, where we cover all the drone news on our website.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Pixel Drone Show, our weekly podcast where we talk to industry professionals about what they do in the UAS space.
From professionals who use drone to fly inspection missions to public safety users or even drone light shows, you will learn on the Pixel Drone Show that drones are much more than just toys.
What's going on, Haya?
Hey, man. How are you today?
Doing good. We've been racking our brain around this new advisory circular that the FAA just published for recreational pilots. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. People should be all over that one if they want to create areas where they can fly.
Yeah, we did a video a couple of days ago. I think it's going to be live by the time people watch this. It's interesting to me. The FAA asked for comments on this thing. So this, let's kind of clarify it. So it's an advisory circular. It's a document that the FAA publishes for guidance typically. But in this one, they're basically saying that they're going to be selecting CBOs, community-based organizations, which is something that they quite frankly should have done 4 years ago when it was mandated by Congress, but that's a sidebar. This document finally has tips on how CBOs will create guidelines, and people that fly for recreational purposes have to follow a CBO guideline. That's part of 44809 regulation. And now we have a pathway for these CBOs to, one, to be accepted as CBOs, because until now we didn't have any, but also to have these CBOs create guidelines. And the document, I wasn't super impressed with the first iteration that they put out for comment. That was back over a year ago. That was July of 2021. I had made quite a few comments to them, but they came back with something that was still, I think, way too complicated. So I'm fairly afraid at this stage that these guidelines are going to be too complex and that people are just going to skip. What's your feeling on that?
I was going to say running joke. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but it's definitely a theme that if you want people to comply and to play the game according to the rules, then things should be simple and straightforward. And I don't know if this one is, to be honest. I think what matters for a lot of people, especially the ones flying FPV drones, if you want to be able to fly a drone and you don't have remote ID, which now is not an issue yet, but will be next year, you have to fly in an FAA recognized identification area. And this guidance allows you to set up those areas. So I think it's important for these organizations to realize that if they want to create those spaces, this is the time to get busy, basically.
This was an important document, and I know we've been waiting for this for a long time, and it's out, and we'll see the response from the community. I think when the document first came out as a open for comments, I made a big video because nobody was talking about it. And I was like, why is no one talking about this? This is kind of a big deal. The FAA is asking for comments. I don't think there were a lot of comments that were submitted. Hopefully this doesn't have too much of an effect on the community. I hate to see people flying unsafely. And obviously this helps a little bit with that, but there's a fine line, I think, between too much regulation and common sense regulation that, doesn't... we'll see.
But the one thing that stood out to me, though, is that if you have a drone that is equipped with a remote ID, which let's say every modern consumer drone at that point will be, you're not allowed to turn it off, even if you fly within Enfria. Do you know why that is?
Just because they don't want people to turn it off elsewhere. And this was something that they made clear from day one. They said, if you have a drone that has remote ID, even if you fly in a Freya, you're still going to be broadcasting because we don't want you to be able to turn it off. But that actually brings kind of an interesting comment, because the way that the Avada is going to comply with remote ID, it is remote ID compliant, right? It was approved by the FAA. It's got the means of compliance approval on the FAA website. But the way that it's going to comply with this is that you're going to be able, you're going to plug your phone into the goggles, and that's what's going to give you a remote ID. The interesting thing is, in flight, if your phone loses power, whatever it is, or if you unplug it, right, it's no longer going to be remote ID compliant. At this stage, the FAA says in the rules, well, technically, you're supposed to come back and land, but really, there's nothing that's going to force you to do that unless DJI puts something in the software that says that, you know, your remote ID has been non-functioning for 2 minutes, and now you need to come back and land and force land. So I don't know what they're going to do, quite frankly, but it's going to be interesting.
Still stuff to be ironed out, right?
Oh, a lot. I think we have another year with remote ID, and there's going to be plenty more changes. Hopefully more modules that are going to come up. Actually, we're going to try to bring on a guest that builds the first remote ID module that was approved by the FAA. We'll have a better insight, I think, into what it takes to build that module. I've always made it sound like it should be pretty simple, but maybe it's not. And so I think we'll get his point of view. But we have a different guest today. That's Jeff Clementi from Skybrowse. Skybrowse does a lot of cool stuff where they create models very quickly using videos, which is a different way than any other software company out there is doing 3D models. So I'm excited. What are you looking for the interview?
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I know Jeff as well. I think it's cool to talk to somebody who has hands-on experience both flying drones as well as being a first responder. So we get the, how do you call that? You get the first-hand experience and stories. And I'm looking forward to picking his brain and see what he wants to share with us.
Yep, I agree. And hopefully we can get a scoop on something they're working on that they haven't talked about yet.
We're going to try. So,
cool. Let's bring him on. All right. Well, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we've had a lot of conversations at different trade shows in the evenings, talking about your background and the things that you did before you joined Skybrowse. So Haya and I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how did you get started with using drones, and then we'll go from there talking about what you've done with drones, the cool things.
Absolutely. So as a hobby, I've always been into the RC aircraft stuff. Started out way back when flying collective pitch helicopters before gyros were gyros and GPS was GPS and all that fun stuff was integrated. Actually, my first collective pitch helicopter, spent a couple $100 on it. By the time I actually learned to fly it, I probably had $2,000 or $3,000 in rebuilding it. So that was then. I've got 15 years in the fire service. So at some point, I believe it was somewhere around when the Phantom 3 released, I started to realize that the RC stuff could be super valuable when it comes to the fire department primarily. I didn't realize what that would expand into at the time. But back around 2017, we had a big hazmat call. Drones were not being used in our department. I just so happened to have an Inspire 1 in the back of my Dodge Charger. I called the incident commander. I'm like, hey, chief, I've got the drone in the back of the car. Do you think it'd be useful for what we've got? It was two tractor trailers collided, burning chlorine. It was a really nasty call. So long story short, I showed up, pulled the Inspire 1 out of the back of the car, and Rutherford County was changed. The next day, I was getting phone calls of, hey, how do we implement this? How do we get this going in Rutherford County? So that was back in 2017. To roll forward a little bit, now I am the VP of Business Development for Skybrowse, which, you know, rapid 3D mapping and modeling we've talked about. But I'm also really passionate about the volunteer side of stuff. So there's a nonprofit called StormPoint that I also volunteer for. I'm the operations manager for StormPoint, and that's kind of how I got involved in the whole mapping and modeling with drones. I met Bobby Ouyang, the CEO of Skybrowse, had to have been close to 3 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. He didn't actually realize that people were crazy enough to do what we were doing. We go and we sit in the middle of hurricanes and ride it out. And when we get a moment, we go and do SAR. When everything goes through, we'll map, we'll model, we'll do whatever is needed. But the fact that we were volunteering to do it kind of hit him. So at that point, he actually gave us a trial. It wasn't even a trial. He gave us a full-blown, here's Skybrowse, use it. And we've used it ever since. So we've mapped out everything from, you know, 100-mile tornado paths to just about anything you could possibly think of. And then a little over a year ago, he called me up. He's like, so how do you feel about coming to work for Skybrowse? And here I am. So end user turned into, you know, employee, I guess.
Can't really wish for a better brand ambassador than you, right? I mean, you come from being a customer and a user basically to now working for Skybrow. So that's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. And it's from the day we got it. I mean, it was good stuff. You push a button, it makes a 3D model. But to where it's at now, it's really mind blowing. I still can't wrap my head around all the how it actually works.
Well, we're definitely going to talk more about that, but I want to go back a little bit in time. You mentioned the Inspire 1 2017 when you first flew it in a hazmat situation. Even 2 weeks ago when we were at DJI Airworks, when I talked to a lot of people there, it seems like among the first responders, still the idea of using drones is not as obvious as, let's say, you or Greg and I would expect it to be at this point. Can you explain to us what it was back then in 2017 that made your fire chief understand immediately what the value was of drones and what we can now do in terms of doing a better job to get that message across to every other fire department that's not yet using drones?
Yeah, absolutely. The big thing, seeing is believing. Actually having the technology in front of you. I'll be 100% honest. When I showed up to that call and pulled the drone out of the back of the car, there were people there actually cracking jokes. Like, what is this kid going to do with this toy he's got? And sadly, it's a lot of agencies and a lot of departments are still looking at it as toys. That call specifically. So I don't want to deep dive too much into the hazmat side of things. But we had monitors out. We had Area Ray Pros out monitoring for chlorine, monitoring for all that kind of stuff. And they're great. They're ground level. They work. But the fact of the matter was we had neighborhoods all around us. With the drone in the air from 300 feet, we could actually watch the plume shift in real time. We could watch where the smoke was going. We were able to evacuate neighborhoods long before those monitors actually picked up the chlorine that was in the air. So it gave us a heads up on that sense. Now, you can actually go on YouTube, and I don't even remember what it's under, but if you look up Inspire 1 Hazmat Recon, R-E-C-O-N, the video is still on YouTube. At the time, our emergency management didn't care. They were like, yeah, absolutely. That video is awesome. Put it out there. But yeah, that video is still on YouTube of me actually flying over the box truck, looking down inside the truck to see what was still burning. At the time, they couldn't tell what was still burning. They didn't even know, you know, did one pallet catch fire? Was it two? What did they actually have? And at that point, the only other alternative was to send somebody down there in full gear, SCBA, ladder the box truck and look down into the burning methyl ethyl bad stuff to see what it was that was burning. So actually getting the drone over there and being able to look straight down into it. And if you watch the video, I literally flew underneath tree canopy where you can't see from the helicopter. Tennessee Highway Patrol was there flying. They had eyes on everything. But the video feed that I had, I actually had incident. We didn't have live streaming and stuff at that point. I had incident commander on one shoulder, a battalion chief on the other shoulder, both of them looking over my shoulders for 7 hours straight, watching what the Inspire was seeing, being able to make those decisions. And then on top of that, as we were sending crews, as we mitigated some of it, as we were sending crews downrange, their comfort level was a whole lot easier. It was a lot easier to make decisions because they knew exactly what was going on. They had eyes there at the incident. Yeah. They could see their guys as they were mitigating the hazards of, you know, burning chlorine. It's not a small thing. So if something was to happen, they know right away. It's not waiting for someone to call out on the radio that they need help. That actionable data, having data in front of you that you can make decisions off of and having it be actionable, having the people that are making the decisions being able to see that, it's game changing. It's revolutionary.
Yeah. And this is not even including things like thermal cameras. We're not talking about modeling a scene of an accident. This is purely eyes in the sky so that people can see what's going on and where the fire is.
Yep. So we've used it for fires. We've used it for hazmat. We do a lot of search and rescue. We have mutual aid agreements with state parks. We go on every state park in Tennessee that has someone missing. The use cases have expanded exponentially. Yeah. This was just one call that just happened to be, you know, it was the right tool for the job. And that's not to say drones are always the right tool for the job. Some people think they have a drone, they have to use it for everything. And that's not the case. But we do right now in Rutherford County, we launch a drone on probably 75 to 80% of the calls that we actually run.
Wow. So this was 5 years ago. What have you seen in the last 5 years in terms of improvement in the drone technology that you really wish you had 5 years ago on that job site, for example?
Oh, thermal is the big one. If we had thermal back then, it would have been a whole lot easier to see, you know, what kind of hotspots we were dealing with and all that. Since then, you know, like I said, I volunteer for a nonprofit. We have very low budget. There's a lot of stuff that we've developed in-house, putting hazmat monitors on drones. We took a confined space monitor with 30 feet of glass line tube, the same stuff that we would use to drop in a hole for confined space rescue, and mounted it to a drone. We can actually monitor without ever getting the prop wash into the area, into the nasty environment. We can drop that tube down from the drone and we can actually monitor, you know, four gases. We can monitor explosive. We can monitor all sorts of stuff that back then it just wasn't available. It's absolutely possible now to get a chlorine sensor on a drone, whether it be on the drone, hanging below the drone, whatever it may be. And then there's all the other products like the visual methane detectors, that kind of stuff. 5 years ago, we would have never thought would have been possible. Obviously I work for Skybrows. I'd like to plug it every chance I get, but on the Skybrow side of stuff, you can actually see the slope of something. You can see where the runoff's going to go. You make a 3D model, you can tell that goes down 2 inches in 5 feet. But the tools that drones add to public safety, fire, all that, I mean, we'll have stuff a week from now that I never would have thought would have been available.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Yeah.
So earlier this week, there was a news story about Hamilton County Police Department in Ohio. They have two helicopters running these helicopters. So not purchasing them, just operating them for a year long comes at the expense of $3 million. And the police chief there had a explained that basically now they're selling the helicopters and instead they're going to buy 15 DJI M30 drones at the total price of $300,000. So they're going to save a ton of money and basically be able to equip every police car in that county with a drone ready to be put in the air. Is that a trend that you foresee happening on a larger scale, that helicopters are going to get replaced by drones?
Honestly, no. So we fly a lot with Tennessee Highway Patrol. We also fly with the National Guard. There's a ton of stuff that you can see from a helicopter that you just can't see from a drone. A lot of that's changing. We had a manhunt a couple months back where we actually got an SGI waiver to fly at 1,000 feet. But flying at 1,000 feet, you can see a lot more than what you can see flying from 400 feet. So there's a lot of regulatory factors that play into that. Once we can circumnavigate some of those regulations, drones will become more useful and may start encroaching on some of the stuff that helicopters do. But let's be honest, right now, you're not able to go do a pickoff. You're not able to drop a line and have people sitting there to pull a patient up into a drone.
Yeah.
Not to say that won't happen in the near future, but there's a lot of stuff that a drone just simply can't do. Like I said, we work hand in hand with the helicopters around here. We fly with them on, you know, most of the missing people. Helicopter shows up, drones show up, and they work really well together. So we actually had a missing person. Helicopter showed up to actually hoist divers down into a ravine. The hoist didn't work at the time. So they landed the helo next to our drone trailer, and the helo pilot actually came in, sat inside of our drone trailer, and sat there watching monitors. And the stuff that they could point out from their experience was a lot different than me as a drone pilot, what I was actually seeing on the monitors. And they realized at that point, that's when our relationship actually got, you know, enhanced to the point where it is now. But he looked at the monitors. He's like, there is no way I could put a helicopter where you just put that drone. And I looked at him and I said, there's no way I could do a pickoff with my drone. You know, so they definitely complement each other for sure.
Yeah, so not too long ago, there was a desert race. I think it was Baja California, where a helicopter and a drone collided. And part of probably the biggest reason why that happened was there was just not a clear plan and division of the airspace between the drone and the helicopter pilot. How would that work in emergency situations when there is even less time to figure out how to share the airspace in a safe way when you have both the drone and, let's say, police helicopter or rescue helicopter up in the air?
Absolutely. So I know in Rutherford County, we know when Tennessee Highway Patrol is coming. We know when Nashville is bringing their helicopter. And on the emergency services side, we have direct communications with them. It's very easy to get on the radio. We don't even have to use airband. We have, you know, all the other radio communications that we have. The very first time we actually flew with THP, it was a rather interesting story. It was probably 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago. Looking for missing persons, they showed up. We're like, hey, by the way, we have drones operating at 280 feet. And they're like, that's fine. We'll stay above that. Life is good. I looked at Russell, the director of StormPoint. I'm like, that helicopter looked rather low to you? He says, yeah, absolutely. We got on the radio. And the helicopter pilot literally told us, oh, you're good. I'm at 290. So not knowing separation distance, not knowing that that's probably a bad idea because we didn't operate together very often. But that changed things. So that started the conversation and, you know, we lowered the drones, helicopters low, get the drone out of the way. But that started the conversation where now when they're coming, we tell them we're at 200 feet. They're like, okay, we'll stay at 5. It's no big deal. But we have that clear communication. And the other big thing is they're usually operating off of MSL. So we need to clarify we are 250 feet above ground level. And yep. They will tell us that's good. We will stay 500 feet above ground level. So communications is the big part, right? Making sure you have that open line of communications and making sure you're clear. Don't just say I'm at 250 feet because 250 for a drone is a lot different than 250 for a helicopter. So just the common communication and having the same, you know, same language helps a lot.
Yeah. No. I got a follow-up for you. Sorry, sure. Greg. One more. Oftentimes in the news, we read stories about there's a wildfire and they're trying to put the fire out, but now you have this guy with a recreational drone trying to get pictures or video footage of the scene of the accident or disaster. Is that something that you run into frequently in your neck of the woods? And can you explain perhaps to the people listening to the show why it's so important that you don't interfere with your own drone when emergency operations are taking place?
Yeah, so we don't necessarily run into that because we don't have crazy wildfires like they do out west. I'm here in Middle Tennessee. I did work the Gatlinburg fires. I was actually a firefighter at the time, actually interior structural firefighting, and they were doing airdrops. We didn't necessarily have that conflict. Whether we did or not, it may have been there, but no one reported anything. We don't know, you know. But it's definitely an issue. So you have people that are literally trying to save lives and save property and save, you know, whatever they can. Those aircrafts are there for a reason. They're showing up on people's worst day. And unfortunately, I refer to CGP a lot, cool guy points. A lot of people flying drones are simply looking for cool guy points. They're looking for stuff they can post to Facebook saying, hey, look what I did. And the ignorance involved there is staggering. Now, there's a lot of really good media outlets that do fly every tornado that comes through. They'll show up, they fly. But it's getting more difficult for them. A lot of people hated DJI's geofencing. Now DJI's geofencing saves us from a lot of that because we put up a TFR. The geofencing says, hey, you're not supposed to be here. So the technology, I think, will help, you know, solve some of that. But it's definitely a huge problem. For one, if you were only flying at 30, 40 feet in your backyard, that's fine. But if you're not getting the shot that you want and you're willing to take that drone to somewhere else, I'm not saying it's fine. If it's illegal, it's illegal. But I don't think that's the stuff people are worried about. It's, hey, I can see that way better from 1,000 feet. I'm going to put my drone all the way up there. Well, then we're going to have problems. And it is ignorant. You're costing other people their, you know, their livelihood, their property, their lives for that matter.
Yep. And that's something that we've been trying to educate people about, you know, but it's difficult, I think. Until we have the manufacturer's help to get some pamphlets and some information in the boxes, I don't think we're going to get there. But we've had a discussion many, many times, and I'll just shut up. let's talk about hurricanes. We had Hurricane Ian in Florida recently. Can you talk about what StormPoint does and what you've done on the site of different hurricanes? What's the value of drones when it comes to post hurricane apocalypse, if I want to call it that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to actually share my screen here, if that's all right. So I don't have any of the data sets from the hurricane released yet, because we won't release, StormPoint will not release a data set if we don't have permission from the people that we collected it from. That being said, Russell's been down. He actually just got back yesterday. He was down there mapping and modeling all sorts of stuff. I'm going to bring up a 3D model of the 100 miles of tornado that came through Kentucky. And I'll just talk about that for a second, how that was actually used during the incident. It wasn't just used after the incident. It was used for dozens and dozens and dozens of different things throughout our response to Kentucky. So this is 180 acres. It was done in one flight with a Matrice 210, you know, uploaded, processed, so on and so forth. Incident Command had a data set. So they actually had two of these every day. So we were able to get these, and this was before SkyRouse Hyper was released. So it did take a little bit longer to process, but we were able to get command these kind of data sets within, you know, 30, 40 minutes. And we were able to get them twice a day. So everybody from utilities that needed to know the new poles that they were setting, if they had 10 feet of clearance on both sides of the poles, they could go set new poles. But you take a large scale disaster, something like this, firefighters lost their properties. They lost their houses, police departments, police officers lost their stuff. This is a local incident. So the emergency responders that were then responding to stuff the next day, the day after that, like cleanup, people may get hurt. Ambulances are still rolling. It might not be the same crew that's normally there. These were used in the briefings every single morning saying, hey, by the way, this road is closed. That road is closed. You're not going to be able to get up this driveway. You're not going to be able to get down to the end of that road. Someone has an emergency, they can make decisions based on an actionable data set.
How is this done before?
A lot radio traffic. So a lot of disaster stuff relies on insurance company data. So insurance companies are willing to pay airplanes to come through and map, and then they get data sets, but it's usually like a week later, if not 2 weeks. So drones are now being used, and it's not just SkyBrowse. You know, there's other great products out there. I think SkyBrowse is probably the fastest as far as, actually, I know it's the fastest as far as doing all this stuff. But drones are definitely being used for more documentation stuff. We're just fortunate now to be able to do it fast enough that we can actually get data sets while the incident is actually happening, while people are actually responding initially, which it was unheard of before. You know,
I hope Romeo Dersher is watching, because I remember him giving a presentation at, I think that was DJI Airworks as well, a couple of years ago, where with the Paradise Fire in California, yep. It took them days to make one map. And I think that's also where Romeo had his dislike for SD cards or micro SD cards from.
Oh, yeah.
It was a ton of work to have the drones, get all the images, collect all the cards, process them, and then wait for the maps to be populated. How long did it take you to make this map, you said?
So this was one flight with a Matrice 210. It's 100 and almost 190 acres, I believe. I could measure it, but processing took about 25 minutes. We did have to upload it, which at the time was a huge pain in the butt. We did actually have to drive. The thing about a tornado, it's local. You can drive 15 minutes and you hopefully have internet service somewhere. So in this instance, we did have to drive to upload data. Since then, Starlink is game changer. We have a couple Starlinks. We brought them down to the hurricanes in Florida, and that's what we were uploading data on. With SkyBrowse Hyper right now, this exact same model would probably take about 10 minutes to process, maybe 5 to 10 minutes to upload using Starlink. So within 20 minutes, you have an actionable data set.
That's insane. I mean, I can imagine, especially during like what you were saying, when the situation is still developing, assuming you can fly a drone safely, at least to be able to update maps and show people what's happening and where a fire is spreading or where a flood is moving into. That's invaluable. Can you explain something about or more about the technology that SkyBrowse uses to be able to make these maps this quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So we use patented videogrammetry. We have our own algorithms to process video files. A couple nerd notes. So your typical SkyBrowse flight, it does two circles, makes a 3D model of an acre or smaller, takes about a minute and a half to fly. So if you take the amount of pixels, we're on the pixel show, ironically, if you take the amount of pixels in a 4K video, multiply that by 30 frames a second, multiply that 30 frames a second times 190 seconds, there's actually 1.5 billion more pixels in that video file than if you were to take 500 images with a 45 megapixel sensor. So the amount of pixels, the amount of data that we have to process is astronomical. It's a ton of data. And then the algorithms to actually process the video file, we're dealing with one file instead of 500 or 1,000. So it's just incredibly fast. Honestly, it's nerds a whole lot smarter than me that were able to come up with some algorithms to process video instead of photos. And the results are fantastic.
And do you lose any in terms of accuracy? Because I know a lot of people are like, oh, we need mechanical shutters, we need high resolution photos, yada, yada, yada. Otherwise, we don't have the accuracy and the precision required. Is there any down? I mean, it doesn't sound like it, but I mean, is there any downside to doing it with video material?
So great question. So we're accurate down to a centimeter. I'm sure you guys know, but I'll talk about it for half a second. There is global accuracy and relative accuracy. So we are relative accuracy. Or law enforcement and public safety, they want to know from this point, they want to know that measurement, and we're accurate to within a centimeter. You can absolutely take the point cloud, the LAZ file, and export it from SkyBrowse and bring it into Esri. You may have to align it on the actual map. It might be off by a couple meters. So we don't have that global accuracy that you would have if you used ground control points. But we're not doing surveying. We're doing down and dirty data collection. That being said, even being down and dirty, it's accurate to within a centimeter.
Yeah. And you're also doing that using infrared. So you can do thermal images, you can do thermal models, right? Is this the same scenario that you would have with photos, or is there a big advantage here to videos when you do that?
So on the thermal side, the advantage is huge. There are some downsides too. I can't say that it's 100% flawless. The downside being the radiometric data is not in the pixels of the 3D model. But being that it's 640 resolution, your typical thermal camera now, 640 lines of resolution in comparison to 4K. So one, video files are a lot smaller. And being that they're a lot smaller, our processing times are a lot faster. Every test we've done, we can literally upload using a cell phone hotspot and process the data in under 2 minutes and have a full 3D model in thermal, accurate within a centimeter. Now it's point cloud, so your pixels are a little bit farther apart. So you're not necessarily going to be able to measure a centimeter. Your pixels might be an inch or two apart. But that being said, when you measure from pixel to pixel, if you needed the measurements, your measurement is going to be accurate. But we're finding a lot more people using it for tactical use cases. You can fly it in 2 minutes, minute and a half, process it in less than 2 minutes. You have a SWAT team show up, fly a drone for a minute and a half, and they have a full 3D reconstruction of that incident with under 5 minutes. They can make tactical decisions on a 3D model in the middle of the night and not need a light source to do it. On the fire department side, first thing we do on the fire service is we do a 360 of the house. We walk around the house to see what we've got. You can do the same exact thing with SkyBrowse. Minute and a half, the drone flies around the house. Well, now you have a data set to show what it looked like when you got there. Do the same thing before you leave, and now you have two comparable data sets that say, look what we did. You actually have physical data in front of you that can show this is what we saved. This is what we were able to accomplish while putting out the fire. Whereas before that, it was burning when we got there. It's not burning now. So I don't want to call it ROI because it's not really a return on investment, but it's definitely a proof of, especially on the insurance side, hey, this is what it looked like when we got there. This is what it looks like when we're done. Good job. Or it's nothing but foundation and it was just a candle lit when you got there. Bad job. So you actually have that quick real time, you know, you have a 3D model in thermal that light source doesn't matter. And it's ridiculously fast.
So I'm looking at the process, and it's a three-step process, right? You fly the mission, that's quick. You, at the end of it, you have the analysis of the mission, that's quick, that's done on your servers. It seems to me like the time saving can be in between the two when you have to land the drone, get the card, put it in the computer, upload. Do you foresee a time where this is going to be eliminated, that the whole process of taking the card out, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Romeo for a long time, where you get rid of the SD card in the process and you take that, and then it takes even fewer minutes to do all this. Do you foresee that happening?
Absolutely. So we took something that used to take 12, 24, 48, however many days it took to process. We're able to do it in minutes now. So I know you're aware, I don't know if everybody is, but we just partnered with Paladin Drones. Paladin does DFR stuff. Drone is a first responder. They just released their EXT module, which is it's a 4G module that goes on a Matrice 300 or an M30, M30T. We're actually working with them right now to make it so the drone offloads that data straight to our servers. So yep. Now you have DFR. The drone flies to an emergency call and starts orbiting it by itself. I say by itself. Somebody pushed a button to make it happen. But we just so happen to make 3D models with stuff that flies circles around stuff. So it's a match made in heaven. Now we can take that video from the drone, have it sent to our servers directly from the drone, from the 4G module that's on the drone. And it does get rid of that SD card step. So that is in development right now.
That's awesome.
So how has the response been among first responders when they see what SkyBrowse technology can do in terms of making those 3D maps available that quickly? And then how much do you think the impact is going to be of having a free version of your software available for them?
Great questions. Honestly, the first response, it's nobody believes it. 100%. I mean, it's, you know, let's be honest. The drone industry is filled with snake oil. There's a ton of snake oil. There's a ton of stuff that people say, hey, we're able to do this, which is why, one, we offer a free trial. We've always offered a free trial. You can sign up, get 2 weeks, test it out, see if it's what we say it is. But that's where freemium comes in. So freemium, it's a free version of SkyBrowse. You can't use all the tools to actually measure. You can't export the point cloud. There's a lot of stuff you can't do with freemium. But what you can do, you can collect a data set, you can upload the data to our servers, and you can make a 3D model. You can absolutely see the results that you're going to get using SkyBrowse, and that's indefinitely. If you want to make a free model 4 years from now, go ahead. It's 100% free. So it takes something that used to take 2 weeks, 3 weeks of training, you know, to make a 3D model with a drone. That was simplified a lot by YouTube and by wonderful people such as yourselves, explaining to people, hey, here's how you can do this. But SkyBrowse takes it a step further. You literally push a button to fly the drone. With freemium, you push a button to fly the drone, take the SD card, upload the video, and you have a data set in front of you. And it's free. So there's that. Try it. See if it is what we say it is. See if you get the speeds that we get.
And does this work with pretty much all common drones that people might have?
So right now, primarily DJI and Altel. We've been fortunate. DJI and Altel both have been over backwards for us. The M3E, while they were developing the SDK, we were working on using that SDK to make SkyBrowse work with the M3E. That being said, we can literally process any video file we can internally. There may or may not be a means coming shortly to upload any video file. Whether it was, say, inside a house or on an airplane or on a drone. And you can actually process those data sets and get a full 3D model. But depending on what's embedded in the video is what will determine the results of the accuracy. So take something like, you know, an Alta X. You can mount any camera you want on an Alta X. You can, in the near future, use an Alta X to make a 3D model with SkyBrowse. Whether or not you have that centimeter accuracy depends on the actual geo data or the GPS data, the altitude data, all the stuff getting embedded in that video, which is one of the things we're actually trying to work out right now, is how to actually get all of the flight log data embedded in the video so we can get that centimeter accuracy using those flight logs. But absolutely, we're trying to be drone agnostic. We want it to work with not only drones, but also, you know, Spot, the Boston Dynamics robot. Anything that can take video, we can process. We're just trying to get it to the point where we actually have the other data that we need to make it accurate.
So a lot of these mapping software out there, they can't use some of the drones that don't have an SDK released for. Do you guys have a workaround this where you can do actually mapping with, let's say, the Mavic 3 Cine or the regular Mavic 3, which is a drone that DJI said they weren't going to support with the SDK?
So eventually, yes. Right now, some of those drones, there's a toggle in there that you can actually turn on subtitle files. And that's hugely beneficial to us because that gives us the basically the flight log data that we would need to process the model. Right now, our app does that. When you fly using the SDK, our servers already know this is the flight log, this is the flight path you took, this is what we need to know to actually process the data. But in development, we absolutely have something in the works that'll use those SRT files or any subtitle file that gives altitude and GPS location. Right now, we can use them internally to make a 3D model. We need that telemetry data to actually make that 3D model accurate as far as relative to size to get those centimeter accuracy.
Yep.
But yeah, absolutely. So we'll be able to in the very near future.
I think about a year and a half ago or so, I saw a video of a SWAT team in California, and one of the police members actually used a small Cinewhoop drone to fly into an apartment building and to see where the guy who had barricaded himself inside actually was hiding. Do you foresee a future where we'd be able to fly a Cinewhoop style drone indoors and then use SkyBrowse to map the interior of the scene as well?
That is a great question. So Greg and his wonderful guys, I'll pull up a video real quick. This is just a teaser. It is not available for purchase at the moment. But the Avata released. Think about the Avata, super wide camera. It is amazing for interior searches. In Rutherford County, we do a lot of interior stuff using Mavic Minis. The Avata came out, game changer. So I called Greg. I'm like, hey, Greg, can you guys do me a favor and just fly the Avata around the studio real quick? And Greg was very kind to do so. And with no telemetry, no flight logs, no data, no nothing, ta-da, we have the inside of the Pilot Institute. So absolutely, stuff is definitely in the pipeline of, I don't remember exactly how long the video file was. I want to say it was like 3 or 4 minutes. Greg, how long did it take him to fly through that? Do you remember?
Yeah, about 3 or 4 minutes.
So it's, 3 or 4 minutes flying through and there we go.
That's insane. I had to spend 4.5 hours in the car with Greg just to see the inside of the studio. Could have just called you and see this video, I guess. How important is the stability of the video footage? Like if the video footage is too shaky, does that matter? Does that make the modeling less accurate? Do you need stabilized footage per se, or how does that work?
So internally, I've taken my cell phone and literally just walked off. I made a 3D model of Siegfried and Roy, maybe someone on the Las Vegas Strip. I literally took my camera out and as we were walking by, I just took a video of it and processed it just for fun. And yeah, the model turned out great. So as far as stabilized goes, I'm sure it probably helps. But as far as the aircrafts themselves go, I mean, you take an Avata, it's stable. You look at the footage, it's, you know, it's more than stable enough for what we need. So does it matter? Probably a little bit. But to the point where the UAS stuff is now, I think it's probably good enough no matter what aircraft you're using.
Yeah. If you have too few frames per second, does that become an issue? I mean, if you drop down, let's say, to 24 frames per second and lower light conditions and it gets more blurry, does that affect your ability to model?
So lower light, we're a lot better in lower light just because video in and of itself is typically better in lower light. But that being said, so if we get down to a certain frame rate, absolutely, you'll see the motion blur, you'll see, you won't have the same data sets. We used an H20N, the DJI's infrared camera, not infrared, but their night vision camera. And we made a 3D model of it. What we didn't realize when we actually made it was when you actually record video, that camera drops down to like 12 frames a second. It's something really, really, really low. We were able to make 3D models with it, but are they the best models? Absolutely not. We can circumnavigate some of that by just slowing the flight down. If we know that a camera is going to be a lot slower frame rate, slow the flight down and we'll still have that same overlap that we would need. So a lot of people don't realize if you fly SkyBrowse at night, it usually takes 30 seconds longer. No one realizes why. It's because we slow the flight down. The drone knows, hey, under this lighting condition, this is what I need to fly this at. You don't have to think about it. It's brainless flying. It does all the calculations for you. So low light, the drone automatically, our software calculates what it needs to do to make the best data set. It slows the drone down a little bit.
That's smart, and it's still way faster than anything we've had in the past. So it's still more than good enough.
Yeah. Even 30 seconds doesn't make that big of a difference.
No.
So you're, I look at this software and I'm like, what's the next thing that they're going to come up with? Right. It's easy to use. It's fast. It's pretty accurate. As a user yourself back in the days and even today, what would you like to see the software do that it doesn't do right now?
There's definitely stuff in the pipeline. So how the data is being used is the big one. I don't want to say we're at the pinnacle of 3D mapping and modeling, because I do think there's, you know, there are better things to, we'll be able to process in 5 seconds, you know, 2 months from now, who knows? But the data sets themselves, how they're actually used. We're working on something right now called TacBrowse, which is real-time tracking within a 3D model. Basically, anyone that has a cell phone that opens an app, it'll track them in real time in a 3D model. We're working on some AI algorithms with various aircrafts that'll actually detect people, using that AI, taking those people and putting them inside of a 3D model in real time. Now you have two different data sets in the 3D model. Combine the two, now you know these are our people. These are the people that have the app installed. These are, you know, Blue Four. There are police officers on the ground. Here are all the points of people that the drone sees. Now we know who's who. You can make actionable data looking at a 3D model with elevation, with everything else. There's a long way for the technology to go. I think the big thing, though, is how those actual data sets are used, how they're analyzed after the fact, and what they're actually used for after the fact. I think that's where we have a long way to go.
Are you saying that theoretically it'd be possible to fly a drone around a building with a thermal camera and identify the cops from the person who has barricaded himself in a room?
Absolutely.
That's insane.
So let's see.
That's what RoboCop does.
I can think of a number of situations
where that might have been helpful not too long ago in Texas, for instance.
So we were very, very, very fortunate a little while back. We got a $10 million grant through, I think it was through DHS. It was either DOD or DHS, but we got a $10 million grant to work on something to help with active shooters, which is when Bobby came up with the idea of using, we call it TacBrowse. So what we've got, this was at Teeks. This was just a little test we did and made a little video of it. But you can see Jeff Clementines, not me. I don't know if that must be another Jeff, but walking around this rock pile. And you can see Bob, that's our CEO, walking the other side of the rock pile. If you notice, I'm actually doing all the walking and Bob's kind of staying still. I don't want to point that out, but it happened. but, you know,
he was rock climbing.
This is, it's real time tracking of people in a 3D model. And you take some of this stuff. I won't get into a Midnight Sun or some of the other projects that we're working on right now too much. But we all know that it is easy for a video feed to identify this is a person, this is not. And with some of the new stuff like laser rangefinders, it's very easy to get GPS coordinates of those things that are being detected by the AI. And
what exactly do you need to be able to identify a person? You need them to have the app on their phone active, or?
So these blue dots, I had TacBrowse installed on my phone, Bobby had it installed on his phone, and yeah, it tracks the phone. And then it puts it into our servers and in real time shows us where those are actually being tracked.
Wow. What's the delay on the data?
So seconds, maybe. If I was running, I could probably outpace it by 5 feet, maybe 10 feet, maybe if I was actually running. but a whole lot closer than not having the data at all, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, how did the dragonfish get there? I don't know what that's all about.
Next question I have. You keep saying you press one button and everything happens automatically. As the drone pilot, the pilot in command, can you still overrule the flight and take control in the case you have to?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like any other autonomous software. With DJI, we do a lot of training with departments all over the place. When I say we, StormPoint does a lot of training with departments all over the place. So we teach people, if you're flying DJI, switch it to sport mode. DJI will not fly an autonomous mission in sport mode. It kicks it out of autonomy right away. So there is absolutely a pause button or a stop button in the SkyBrowse app. I still tell people, flip it to sport mode. And Alltel is very similar. Alltel has a pause button on the remote. You can use that pause button. So yeah, there's absolutely a way to stop it mid-flight. You know, if you were to come too close to a power line or whatever it may be, you can absolutely stop the aircraft.
Yeah. Follow-up question I have. I mean, if so, you press one button, the drone launches, circles the building. Are first responders concerned that at some point that drone might be behind the building and therefore not be able to maintain visual line of sight with the drone?
Yes and no. So for one, a lot of people are operating under COAs right now as far as public safety goes. Mm-hmm. And tactical BVLOS is a thing. It's not a hard thing for public safety to get, which is exactly that. It's not flying a mile away from you, but it is flying close enough to you, but you might not be able to see it because of obstructions. And limited altitude and that kind of stuff. But we can make 3D models from 150 feet AGL. You fly up to a point where you can still see the aircraft and push a button. So as far as all that goes, you know, there's definitely ways to mitigate and actually maintain line of sight. So there's also ways to get around all of that. We file SGIs with StormPoint all the time, special government interest waivers. Mm-hmm. We get BVLOS a lot, and we do get it. You know, we had the dragonfish out on a manhunt. We got 6 mile radius around an area that we were trying to fly. The dragonfish will go 16 miles. So we got a waiver to fly 6 miles. We knew the guy was somewhere in this area. We get that waiver. We can fly BVLOS. So there's absolutely ways to do it legally to get around the whole BVLOS thing. But even if you don't have a waiver, fly it a little higher or stand a little further back. There's absolutely things that you can do to still maintain line of sight.
Yeah. And those waivers, you need to be able to get them on a case by case or situation by situation basis, right? How quickly and how easy is it for a first responder to get that waiver when time is of the essence?
Oh man, we could have a whole show on this. This is one of my babies. I'm one of those people that you tell me I can't do something and I'm going to show you that I can. So
there you go.
The last search we had, we got a BVLOS waiver for 1,000 feet AGL with a 6 mile radius. So we had a huge area we could fly, and not only that, but we could fly it at 1,000 feet. It was pushed through in an hour, and that was probably one of the longer ones that we filed. I've gotten authorizations for stuff, you know, within 20 minutes, 30 minutes. We had a downed aircraft, 10 passenger jet took a nosedive into the lake. I actually got verbal authorization, and that was in zero grid in class Delta. I got verbal authorization to go ahead and fly BVLOS in zero grid in class Delta from SOSC. We worked on the paperwork, but something like that, I had the airport manager standing next to me. I had the tower manager there. It wasn't something that was a shock to anybody. It took off from their airport. So situation dictates needs, and it also affects that whole timeline. But usually we're able to get BVLOS is a little different because they have to put up a TFR, for us to get that BVLOS, but it's usually within an hour.
Yeah. And does the FAA, sorry, Greg, real quick, they recognize local BVLOS or tactical BVLOS at this point, right? So if you just ask him to be able to fly around a building, the process would be less complicated and less lengthy, I would hope.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
The first SGI I filed, they were like, why can't you see a half a mile? They're coming from the manned aviation side. This 3 years ago. Well, I've got trees all the way around me. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Go ahead and fly, you know?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you have to put in there? You know, when we think about BVLOS right now, the FAA wants to have a whole lot of reasons. How are you going to be able to see traffic? Is the fact that you have a TFR built around it makes getting that BV loss waiver a lot easier?
Yes, that is the only way that SOSC will approve. As of right now, that's the only way that the FAA Systems Operations Support Center will approve a BVLOS operation for emergency response. Is for us to put up a TFR. And once that TFR goes up, you have one person designated to answer the phone. When somebody needs to fly there, they're going to call you. So that's one of the mitigations. We still do stuff like strobe lights. We still try to spread out visual observers. We take one of our visual observers and we have them watch the telemetry data on a monitor. So we have separate eyes looking at battery and that kind of stuff. So we try to put as many safety factors in as we can. But right now, as far as an emergency waiver goes, TFR is it.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's been awesome to talk to you today. I mean, you have a wealth of knowledge and hands-on experience, both when it comes from flying drones, but also being a first responder yourself. So definitely appreciate your input today. At the end of our interviews, we typically end the show with our favorite question. And our favorite question for you is, what is your favorite drone to fly? And doesn't have to be in an emergency situation, just next Saturday. What would you take with you?
Right now, the Avada. Hands down.
Yavada. Why?
For one, it's fun to fly. It flies like an FPV drone, but you don't have to, not that you don't have to pay attention. You don't have to have the stick control that you would for typical FPV. And I fly both. To me, it's a casual FPV, just a lot of fly.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a favorite for a lot of different people. So, well, Jeff, thanks for joining us. Always great to hear your side of the story and then hear that Skybrowse is actually doing a lot of cool things. I actually didn't know about a couple of these, and I'm really excited to see where you guys take this. So say hi to everyone on the team over there, and then we'll see you next time.
Absolutely. Always good talking to you.